This is Matt Davis, and you're listening to Finding Etheridge on Cultural Manifesto. Finding Etheridge explores the people and places connected to the Pulitzer Prize-nominated poet, Etheridge Knight. Etheridge Knight was born in Mississippi in 1931. He began writing in the 1960s while serving time at the Indiana State Prison. Or, as Etheridge wrote in his famous 1968 book, Poems from Prison, "I died in Korea from a shrapnel wound and narcotics resurrected me. I died in 1960 from a prison sentence and poetry brought me back to life." Etheridge Knight died in Indianapolis, Indiana in March 1991, but his legacy grows ever stronger with each passing year.
The idea of ancestry. I am all of them, they are all of me. I know their style, they know mine. I was beginning to forget who I was.
On this edition of Finding Etheridge, I'll share the second half of my conversation with Elizabeth Gordon McKim, also known as the Jazz Poet of Lynn. Elizabeth was Etheridge Knight's partner and companion during the final years of his life. Elizabeth lives in Lynn, Massachusetts. She recently visited Indianapolis for the unveiling of a new Etheridge Knight mural on Massachusetts Avenue. Etheridge and Elizabeth live together on Mass Ave at the Barton Tower Housing Project. Let's join my conversation with Elizabeth Gordon McKim as we discuss her connection to Etheridge Knight and her latest collection of poems titled Elizabethridge, A Memoir in Poetry. One kind of famous quote or kind of a part of his like writing philosophy is this idea or concept of the poet, the poem, and the people. And if you're an Etheridge Knight fan, you've probably heard that in one of his recordings or what have you. But can you kind of break that down for people who don't quite understand the relationship that he's trying to bring up there? And then if you do, then I still want to hear you explain it to all the people who feel like they know.
Okay. The poem, the poet, and the people. Well, that was an essential teaching of Etheridge Knight. And certainly, you know, we people, we free peoples be who teach, you know, for me, that was something that I just passed on, especially reading poems out loud. The poem, that's the thing you hold in your hand, the poem. Who are you? You're the poet. And the third thing is the people. So it's like the energy comes from these three things. And if you forget your people, that's very simple. Your people are going to forget you. If you're so nervous about reading the poem that you're just thinking, I can't read, it makes me so nervous, I'm going to cry, you're going to forget your people. So it's important. In a way, it's a healing thing to think, you know, remember your people. They want to hear you. They don't want to hear you, you know, shivering and trembling about reading the poem. And so that was so important, a teaching. It's a three-way thing. It's not all about you as the poet. No, it's about this three-way thing, the poem, the poet, and the people. So that brought energy, and it's a very easy teaching, like write your head off and your heart out, you know. That's an easy thing. You can teach, you know, children that. When you stand up and read that poem, you are the poet, you know. And nobody knows what's on your page. That's what I tell the kids, too. They don't know what's on your page. So you can make up stuff, too. They won't know. But just remember that you got the people out there. So don't forget the people.
Yeah, one thing that was most beautiful about that for me was the fact that it didn't say audience. It said the people.
Yes.
Right? And so that means more than just the listeners or the consumers of whatever it is you're producing. It's also about the values, the culture, the experience, the struggles, the issues of a people that you're a part of, you know?
Thank you so much for saying that. And that's so important. And I think that people forget that a lot this day with so much digital information and new things coming in and a lot of, you know, especially the pandemic and people have been suffering so much and mental illness and everything. Yeah, that this is one of the ways that can help us to heal, you know, and it's not just the audience. No, it's the people. we free peoples. And it's not just one people, because Etheridge was very important. We free peoples. We free peoples. There's many different peoples. And it's a very large table that we belong to. And it doesn't mean that we can't disagree and that we can't argue and we can't move away, distance ourselves. But we're here in this very big table. And I'm so happy to be part of that, really. And I know you are too,
absolutely,
Matt.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. So many different people going on with this this very deep and wide teaching.
Mm. Speaking of Free People's Workshop, talk to us about him as a facilitator, like in the act of teaching, his kind of, like, what were those workshops like?
They were always interesting, and they were fun, and they were enjoyable, and also they brought people into this sense of community building. And I think that's so much a really important aspect of making art. And usually the workshops, when Etheridge would give what he called a little mini lecture. And I know I give mini lectures too in my workshops. You know, either you read a poem or your thoughts about something. And he would generally start the workshops off in that way. And then basically he would open it up to the people, and they would come up and read their poem. And he would always say, "Speak to us. Come speak to us." And he listened. He listened to those poems. You know, the listening was an energy, the same way as reading a poem. And often he would just, you knew he was taking it in. And then he would make very insightful comments. Not about, "Nah, this poem no good," or nothing like that. No, just about what he heard. And no matter what kind of state Etheridge was in, he was always a teacher. And I think that a lot of the good energy of his teaching came from a sense of love, because that really was where Etheridge Knight began.
Mm, so speaking of love, let's talk about this book a little bit more.
Okay.
So the book is phenomenal. If you haven't already bought it.
I'm so glad you like it.
No, literally, if people haven't already bought this book, you should. And I just wanted to comment about the fact that it's really hard to write a memoir that is like part memoir and almost anthology. You know?
Yes, exactly.
But some collaborative pieces. That's easier said
and
than done.
And also collaborative pieces and also very distinctive Etheridge's voice.
Yes.
See, I think that's important.
Yes.
For instance, I don't feel that I am an authority on Etheridge Knight. No, I feel like I experience my experience, and then that's all I can do. And I think my experience is valid. But Etheridge, he's an authority on his life. And he would always say that. He'd say, "So-and-so, he's not an authority on my life." Mm-hmm. So I think that it's very important that our experience, what we know, how we go out with what we hear, is part of the bridge making of language.
Mm.
And your original question, bring me back to
you. Oh, no, you're fine. I mean, if anything, I'd just like to hear a little bit more about how the book came together.
So this started with an essay, and the essay was done really very close to the time where Etheridge died in 1991. And I wrote that in New York City at a friend's apartment, and I just wrote every day. And then as the years went on, I made different connections, and time went on, and parts of it were originally published in the Worcester Poetry Review. But I'm proud of this this essay, and it basically says what I wanted it to say. And that's all that you can ask for a book. Is it true to you?
Mm.
You know, and That's why I'm so grateful that the book came out, and I have a lot to thank for Norm Minnick, who was my editor, my wonderful editor.
Shouts out to Norm Minnick.
So this book, it started with the essay, and over the years, I have so many poems about either like talking to Etheridge or not necessarily. He's not always at the center of these poems, but mainly he is, because we always had the argument with the soul, you know, the conversations, and he will always be part of that conversation for me until my last breath. So a lot of these poems just came over the years. I mean, this has been like 31 years, and they're all poems. Some have been published and some haven't. And then somehow with Miracle, and I always say, well, Norm Minnick had a lot to do with this, because I used to just send him a whole bunch of stuff. And somehow in these last couple of months, we found the narrative arc. Mm. We found, you know, out of so many poems, we found the stories to include in the book. And I don't know. It's somehow, I know we did it quite assiduously, but also there's a mystery about it. And I am very happy that the book came out. I'm so happy because I want people. I'm pleased with it myself. And I guess that's all you can ask about a book. Does it tell the truth as you know it? And I feel that it does. So,
speaking of Etheridge's work being shared in the different mediums, there's his preferences, his philosophy, his approach, and then there's just kind of like the way that poetry gets marketed. And I've always been so curious, like all of his other contemporaries had an album, right?
Or album.
Yeah. And I mean all of his different contemporaries of like the Black Arts Movement era or just other mainstream voices, like, you know, like Richard Pryor had albums, or his peers with Broadside Press, like Nikki Giovanni had albums.
Yeah, she had immediate albums.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Gil Scott-Heron.
I know. Who Etheridge loved. We went to hear him in Boston.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we loved him.
And so then it's always made me think, like, well, why didn't he ever have an album? I was always so curious about that.
Okay, album. Well, first I want to say that there are a number of, videos.
Oh, yeah, I've seen those. Yeah, that always struck me. That was just, it was just such a kind of purist approach to the craft. It's like, well, you have to enjoy it either by yourself in like the solitude of the book, or you got to come out to the event and be.
Well,
one
you
of
know
the
what? I think
us.
If somebody had come up to Etheridge Night during this time and say, "Hey, we want to make an album. Are you up for it?" Of course, he would. Mm. But you know, it didn't really happen that way. No, and there was so much in our life and in Etheridge's life, I should say, chaos, order, chaos, mm-hmm, order, chaos, mm-hmm, order, mm-hmm, chaos, order, mm-hmm, as a natural rhythm, you know, of this life, mm-hmm, as this life was lived. But there wasn't that person that said, I don't even know if they talked about in 1990 about an album as such. I know they do now. And so, no. And too bad you weren't around then.
Yeah, we should have hung out. Yeah,
I know. Well, you're hanging out in a way, in your own way.
Yeah, I was born 2 months after he transitioned.
Oh, my goodness.
In 1991.
Wow.
There you go.
I know in some ways I feel his presence right here in this room.
Oh.
But also, and I know that he would be well pleased with what's going on. I know that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
So, speaking of Etheridge being present, what is your favorite Etheridge Night piece? I'm sure that's a really hard question, but if you had to kind of give...
Are you saying from this book or are you saying from this book?
From any, all of the entire Etheridge Night canon, you know, what is your favorite piece? I know that's probably a really difficult question, but if you had to kind of...
Well, the idea of ancestry, I think, is my most hearted. But also in the poems that were written to me, you know, the one the poem that he wrote about, it's a love poem, and it also has so much to do with something that poets share, which is breath. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think, in the book is my favorite.
Is that the Bette Gordon?
Oh, Bette Gordon. No,
I was like, who is Bette Gordon when I read that piece?
Well, my name is Elizabeth Gordon McKim.
Okay.
And then my family calls me Bette.
Okay.
So
that was a hell
right?
of a poem. That and was a hell of a poem.
The hell of a poem? Oh,
yeah,
I'm glad
absolutely.
You liked that.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, it's a hell of a poem.
It's the one right next to Paducah on like 149 or something like that.
But this is okay. So this is this is the one that belongs. The Bette Gordon is great. I like all of them, but this was the one originally that I loved, and it was published. You can't see it. We're not on TV, but the American Poetry Review. He wrote this poem in a letter to me. Mm. After we were separate, I think, you know, various times we had to be separate.
Yeah.
But here it is in his handwriting and all these different writers here, an American Poetry Review. And, you know, it tells a lot. So I'll read that if that's okay.
Please
with
do.
You. Mizzy, which he called me a lot, Mizzy. Mizzy, oh, Mizzy. Mizzy, oh, Mizzy. Can't you hear me howling down your name? The sound of the wind in my ears does not blow the same as before. A winter thunder now rolls across my shore. Don't you love me anymore? Oh, Elizabethridge, lady of my autumn dream years, I desire the humming of your heart, the blow. Oh, the great blow of your breath and the arching bridge that your motion and your magic make. From the very start of our love, it has been so. And in our love, there is no death.
Mm, that was powerful.
And that was like 1984.
Thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah. And it has a lot. There's a lot that has to do with, you know, as I said last night, that there's a lot of backstories in poetry. So, I'm howling down your name. That actually something that I said to Etheridge. And then this repetition of sound, the sound of the wind in my ears does not blow the same as before. And then the sadness, the somehow something ominous, a winter thunder now rolls across my shore. And then you've got before and shore. And then don't you love me anymore? And then Elizabethridge, the invocation. And suddenly, lady of my autumn dream years. And that struck me because the winter had not come yet. The winter was probably Indianapolis, you know, and the time of Etheridge's dying. Mm. But he felt like this presence of death, really, that was always there, even though he would say we row for joy and not sorrow. So, lady of my autumn dream years, I desire the humming of your heart. So back to the body, the heart, the pulse, you know, all of that. Etheridge knew intimately the heart and the pulse, you know, body, that language is in the body. This poetry is in the body. And it's not like mind, body, the mind and the body, you know. No, it's like one thing. And that's so very important. The humming of your heart, the blow, oh, the great blow of your breath, and the arching bridge that your motion. Now, bridge, you know, I think that being a bridge person, you know, being able to walk that bridge, not to just get walk one way and be stuck on the other side. No, to be able to walk back and forth, the arching bridge that your magic and your motion make from the very start of your love. The very start of our love, it has been so. And I think this is true of, you know, all the recipients of love poems. Like, I think love poems belong to the people, honestly, all of the love poems. And so much of poetry is love poems, even the hard ones and the ones about, you know, how you're stuck and in pain. And then he ends it, I think, in this beautiful way. From the very start of our love, it has been so. And in our love, there is no death. So he brings back this death, same way as in the poem that he wrote to my daughter, Jennifer, where he says he brings back death again. I loathe death. Mm. You know, again, using the repetition of sound.
And that's a consistent theme in a lot of these, like, Elizabeth Ridge love poems. Like, one that haunts me, in lieu of what you're saying, one that haunts me is the When I Slip to Sleep.
Oh.
That shorter one that that you wrote together.
We didn't write that together.
Okay.
That's an interesting thing.
Okay.
The first two poems are Etheridge Knight poems.
Okay.
And when I slip to sleep in spring, leaves will sing.
Yep.
Liz's heart or something. Liz's will seek another song.
Yeah.
So he knew life goes on. Yep. And this is another thing about Etheridge and his death and dying. The thing that comforted him a lot, and it does for a lot of us, is that life goes on. Mm-hmm. You know, and he was, now, of course, we don't really know, but he thought, you know, the earth is going to keep on going after I'm gone. And that was great. And then even for me, you know, Liz's song will seek another, I don't know how, I can't quite remember.
No, it was a terrific piece.
And then the other one, there's two of Etheridge Knight in that. And then mine was Blackbird. My two poems were Blackbird, I Always Loved You, Wherever You Chose to Fly. Mm. Now Call Home.
Yeah, no, like the way that you all came up with all of these different analogies about death and transition, I mean, that's just one of the most beautiful parts about the pieces in the book. And he talked about the analogy of, like, his transition being leaving for a faraway country.
Oh, yes.
And so now that Etheridge is in that faraway country, you know, how do you feel like this mural that's going up on the side of the Chatterbox is cementing that legacy?
What a great question. Yes. It's I know how well pleased, how honored, how humbled, and how happy Etheridge would be for these 2 days and, you know, this time. Because, it was an easy way for him to refer to his death. He'd say, when I go to the faraway country. And so since then I talk about that too. You know, we all have our ways. People say passing on and all of this and past and Etheridge said, when I go to the faraway country, and the faraway country, it's the little thing and the big thing. The faraway country seems to be the big thing, you know, and we're the little things, and we are connected. So I think he'd be well pleased. I know he would be. And that is the exciting thing about all this work and spending time dwelling with this particular person, but also for all of us that we're all going to go to the faraway country, and we all have people whom we love, and hopefully we have young people that will like you, that we do the step aside, and you guys go forward. You know, so it's all, we're all part of it, and that's what makes me really happy. And I feel that Etheridge would be well pleased with all of this. And also that family, that we're part of this family of belief And free, we free peoples be, I think he knew this.
Absolutely. I'm honored to be one of the free people. And
me too.
Yeah, absolutely. So my last question to you is, over the past 30 years, how have you seen the interpretation of his legacy change? Because in the early 90s, you're talking about like the war on drugs. Uh-huh. And perceptions of criminal justice have changed. You know, the conversations about racial justice, racial equality, social justice, all of those things have evolved. And you know, like what it means to reenter society from prison, what it means to be an inmate, part and parcel because of his work in humanizing that existence. You know, how has his legacy changed over the past 30 years? And why is it now that we feel like we're able to kind of embrace him as the complicated hero?
What a great question. I bet you can answer that really well.
I mean, I think about it a lot.
I mean, we all have
I think it's better coming from you.
Okay, but yeah, my thoughts just of the moment. But so I think, you know, there'll always be people. I don't know. I don't feel that people are judgmental about life, but there are people that are. For instance, maybe my book too would be banned from libraries now because of, you know, what's going on in certain parts of the country.
That's a badge of honor to get banned.
That's what Norm Minnick told me too, right? Yeah. How has it changed? Well, I think the people that originally discovered Etheridge Knight and the power of poetry, and other people who have discovered other poets, including myself, that we know, you know, that even people with the deepest flaws and habits, they're not defined by this. And Etheridge did say this often. He said, "I am a poet primarily, and I am a poet who has had a history of drugs and prison, but that doesn't define me. The original definition is I'm a poet who has had this history." And I think that he never denied his history, nor did he deny the history of other people. That was part of it. And I think in all of great literature, if you know the flaws and the scars, what scars and marks distinguish you, that's from a poem of mine, those scars, hold it, warm it with your own life. Listen to its near and far pulse, its sounds, its messages. Find out where it was born, the year, the time, and who was there and why. Find out the nature of its fear, what cliff or curve of tide has touched you, tended you, mended you. Find out what you can know of parents, what song and language you were taught, and if you have a friend, an enemy, what stains and marks and cracks and scars distinguish you, what surface opens to the air, what inside heart is hiding there, and learn the way you live and breathe upon this earth.
Elizabeth, that was so beautiful.
Seriously. Thank you.
Elizabeth McKim, the grand jazz poet of Lynn, Massachusetts, and the very beautiful companion of the late Etheridge Knight. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for continuing to free the people through your work.
Thank you. I appreciate it so much.
My guest this week has been the poet Elizabeth Gordon McKim. Stay tuned to Cultural Manifesto for future editions of Finding Etheridge. And check out the Finding Etheridge podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have stories, memories, or photos related to Etheridge Knight, contact us at findingetheridge@gmail.com. We might include you in an upcoming episode of Finding Etheridge or in the upcoming stage play documenting the life of Etheridge Knight. Finding Etheridge is produced by Kyle Long and hosted and co-produced by me, Matt Davis.